Our chalice lighting today comes from the Muslim mystic Sufi Rumi. Like a sculptor, if necessary, carve a friend out of stone. Realize that your inner sight is blind and try to see a treasure in everyone.
Light is forming, our hearts are unfolding. Beauty is breaking right through the dawn. All loving, all knowing, all giving and growing. This life ever changing within the song. Oh Father, oh Mother, oh Friend and oh Lover, life wonderful. Release us, protect us. Challenge us, guide us through all and all. And love grows when light moves between you and me. We gotta shine that light and make ourselves free. The morning is coming, there's a warm breeze a-blowing. And the birds sing a tune with a melody. All hearts are ascending, all brokenness mending. Strangers and friends are as family. Oh Father, oh Mother, oh Friend and oh Lover, life wonderful. Release us, protect us, challenge us, guide us through all and all. And love grows when light moves between you and me. We gotta shine that light and make ourselves free. Comes the dawn with every day. Make a smile and share it. Give it away, brighten up a cloudy day. Shine a light and share it, bring on the day. Comes the dawn with every day. Make a smile and share it, give it away, brighten up a cloudy day. Shine a light and share it, give it away.
Right compares President Obama to Adolf Hitler. The left compares right-wing conservatives to the terrorist group Al-Qaeda. It seems today that people disagree on more than they agree on. Topics like abortion, marriage equality, immigration, and universal health care are polarizing topics, steeped in not just political, but moral debate. Why is someone always right and someone always wrong? Why can't politicians agree on seemingly anything to pass meaningful legislation? Why is one religion the true way and all the rest just a bunch of made-up stories? Why can't people stop arguing on my Facebook feed? As Unitarian Universalists, we believe in the democratic process and that all people need a voice. But it can be very difficult to listen to someone whose values we do not share. I consider myself a reasonable person and desperately wanted to change the conversation with them, to quiet the inner voice that was screaming, "That makes no sense. How could you think that?" And "You're wrong." That inner voice didn't fit with my values to respect the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It mocked the other person and tore them down. It didn't build connections in the interdependent web of life. It said, "You stay on your side, and I'll stay on mine, and mind the gap." This is the challenge, to reach across the aisle, literally and figuratively, to find common ground and connection with those with whom we seem to share no common values. Come, let us worship together.
H.L. Mencken said, "Under democracy, one party always devotes its chief energies to trying to prove that the other party is unfit to rule. And both commonly succeed and are right." We will now spend a few moments in silence. Now, please join me in the spirit of prayer. This particular prayer comes from Pakistan, from a reform group that has formed in Pakistan. Merciful God, you made all of the people of the world in your own image and placed before us the pathway of salvation through different preachers who claim to have been your saints and prophets. But the contradictions in their teachings and interpretations of them have resulted in creating divisions, hatreds, and bloodshed in the world community. Millions of innocent men, women, and children have so far been brutally killed by the militants of several religions who have been committing horrifying crimes against humanity, and millions more would be butchered by them in the future if you do not help us find ways to reunite peacefully. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, look with compassion on the whole human family. Take away the controversial teachings of arrogance, divisions, and hatreds which have badly infected our hearts. Break down the walls that separate us. Reunite us in bonds of love, and work through our struggle and confusion to accomplish your purposes on earth, that in your good time, all nations and races may jointly serve you in justice, peace, and harmony. Amen.
Our first reading is excerpted from the radio program This American Life. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this radio program. I listen to it on podcast on my daily commute. What I love most about this show is that it frequently exposes the humanity in many controversial topics that mainstream media tries to objectify. This is from episode 453, entitled Nemesis, and is not the complete segment due to length. You can find the complete segment and the entire episode online. The two speakers are Ira Glass, the host of the show, and Peter Coleman, who Ira introduces.
Peter Coleman runs an outfit called the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution at Columbia University, which means that he spends a lot of time thinking about disputes between people that seem unresolvable and what can be done in those situations. And he tells this story, he wrote about this in a book too, about the abortion debate in Boston back in the 1990s. Boston is a very Catholic city, of course.
You know, inflammatory rhetoric really on both sides. And then in 1994, there was a shooting that took place. John Selvo III went into two clinics in Brookline, Massachusetts, and he shot and killed two women, and he took a rifle and put it to the head of one woman and shot and killed her and said, "That's what you get. You should pray the rosary more." I think the pro-life movement was ashamed and infuriated by what had happened. I think the pro-choice movement was terrified and traumatized. And so the governor, the archdiocese, called for dialogue. So they brought these women together, and reportedly the pro-life group had met in a friendlies beforehand and prayed, because they really they feared sitting down at the table with this other side. They really believed that just being near them could taint them, could affect them, because they were, in their mind at the time, they were murderers, and to be with them not only was dangerous, but also could affect their reputations within their own communities, and could put their life at risk, given what had just happened. At first, the conversation was hard, even though they agreed to some guidelines on how to have this conversation in a way that they felt would be constructive. It was hard to hold to those guidelines initially.
You're right about that there was a lot of finger-pointing back and forth. Everybody thought, we're not going to do any finger-pointing, but in fact, they couldn't help themselves.
Yeah,
you're right.
It's what they did. It's what they had been doing. They were used to doing it. They knew the talking points, and it was so hard to try to put those away.
Because basically each side saw the other side as just
evil. Yeah, as evil or insane, absolutely.
In Boston, in the 1990s, after these abortion clinic murders, these women, over the course of their four meetings,
they start to get some sense of the other person, of the other group, that's different from what they came in with. They start to experience each other as women who are decent women. And ultimately, they end up speaking in secret for 6 years, and really come to know each other and come to deeply respect and care for each other, one another, across the divide, all six of these women.
Okay, so they're all getting along so well. They have this amazing dialogue, the kind of thing, really, that seems to never, ever usually happen. Did it nudge any of their views about abortion? Well, again, here's Peter Coleman.
To me, one of the more fascinating things about what happened is that through these conversations, the relationships got thicker. The relationships got more nuanced and more caring, and they became more polarized on the issue of pro-life, pro-choice.
So what does that mean, more polarized?
It means that they became more certain that their point of view on the issue was right, and that the other point of view on the issue from the other side was wrong.
One of the women, Madeline McCormish, explained that this way. She said, having to dig deep to explain your reasoning, you know, and why you believe what it is that you believe in a group like this, it forces you to crystallize your own views. And so, of course, you end up even more convinced about your side. And as a result of this, Peter Coleman says, where they ended up was,
even though they cared deeply about these women, they differed fundamentally on this issue.
So is this a success or a failure?
Well, from where we sit, it's a complete success.
How?
Because what did happen is that the rhetoric changed, that the conversations that would happen publicly around abortion, around pro-life, pro-choice, lost a lot of the edge and the vitriol in the community that it had had prior to the shooting and prior to the dialogue process.
Our second reading is an essay written and recorded for the series, This I Believe, by Robin Mize of Tacoma Park, Maryland, called Finding Our Common Ground. There was a big peace march in Washington a few years back. I watched as my husband made a sign to carry and my son painted slogans on a T-shirt. "Sure, you don't want to come?" my husband asked me. He knew that I was sympathetic to the cause. I felt just as strongly as he and all our friends who were going did, but I couldn't go. I begged off, saying I wasn't comfortable with the crowds. But the thing that made me uneasy wasn't just the number of people gathered there. It was the mob mentality of a large group of people who feel they are right, even if I agree with them. It was the absolutism lurking in its liberal ideals. To me, it felt just as scary as any other kind of intolerance. On the other hand, I know it takes a kind of fervor and belief to change things, but there is a fine line there, and somehow group protests, while I respect them, walk too close to that line for me. What scares me is the self-congratulatory, undiscriminating nature of the mob. I think of the French Revolution. I picture those Nazi rallies, and I fear the self-complacency of knowing that you are right. I wonder if it has to do with the fact that I come from a family in which the liberal is a rare bird. Four of my siblings are staunch conservatives, Republicans. I love them dearly, and the fact that these people whom I love are the evil enemy of the peace march gives me pause. It forces me to accept a contradiction, knowing both things to be true. They are the enemy, but they are also my family. We do not agree, but I have to accept that they are thoughtful and compassionate people who have come to the opposite conclusion about how things should be. I must admit that it is hard for me to disagree so profoundly, yet still respect and love them. Sometimes I wish I could agree with my siblings and not be troubled by these uncomfortable differences of opinion. This brings me to what I believe. I believe we are all doing the best we can. The other side isn't any more ignorant or selfish than we are. They are not Big Business or Big Brother or the International Monetary Fund. They are just like me. I choose to respect their opinions, even if I disagree with them. I am grateful that my children must accept this diversity also. They can't just dismiss the other side as evil. They are forced to love the enemy because the enemy is their loved one. The love came first. It seems to me that here in my family is an essential element of our democracy. We agree to disagree. Our ability not only to accept, but to respect our differences is our common ground.
My favorite principle is the seventh, respect for the interdependent web of life of which we all are a part. That last part, of which we all are a part, is sometimes difficult to comprehend. I love my bubble. I feel safe, affirmed, and optimistic in the social circle that I choose to surround me. But our faith tradition calls us to reach beyond that bubble, to recognize and respect others for who they are and the journey they are on, even if it is very different from our own. In last year's political election, I found this becoming increasingly difficult. I saw ad after ad bashing Republican and Democratic candidates for their platform, their past, even what clothes they wore. I had a cousin on Facebook defending Todd Akin, saying legitimate rape rarely causes pregnancy. And I saw several liberal friends sharing images that bashed those on the right as ignorant or blind to the real issues. As the political rhetoric was really coming into full swing in preparation for yet another election cycle, I noticed a short book review in the newspaper under the heading, Why Liberals and Conservatives Can't Get Along. Now, I've in the past picked up books that claim to discuss this topic of left versus right, conservative versus liberal, and I've been very disappointed. Usually, the author is only seeking to reaffirm the belief structure of its target audience, and 250 pages later has only confirmed what the listener already knew, that the other side is not rational, doesn't know what they're doing, and they're just plain wrong. Not just wrong, destroying America, evil, stupid, repugnant. So as I read through the review, it told me that the book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, was written by one Jonathan Haidt, a professor of ethical leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business and a moral psychologist. The review hinted at moral evolution and the science behind it. I was intrigued. This book seemed different. Here's the book. One caveat is I try to summarize some of the key points that Haidt makes. He painstakingly provides data and proof to back up his model and his conclusions on human behavior and moral evolution. If you're interested in that, it's in the book. I'm not going to try to address that today. The main question that people ask in politics is, why doesn't the other side listen to reason? Haidt addresses this question up front. People don't. We aren't built that way. Instead, our brains act on intuition first, in other words, a gut response, and then determine a strategic reasoning second. We rationalize. We don't learn a moral code and then try to live by it. We're born with a moral blueprint, which is shaped by our experiences and our culture. And we sort of gather our moral code to fit that blueprint. This is further reinforced by surrounding ourselves with a grand narrative that fits our blueprint. Everybody does it. It's further magnified when the media pays the most attention to the extremes. Haidt proves his point by presenting some examples of moral dilemmas and measuring their responses. Some examples are easy. Most people would agree that a bully picking on a smaller kid on the playground is wrong. Harm is being done. But some examples are less obvious. A woman is cleaning out her closet and she finds her old American flag. She doesn't want the flag anymore, so she cuts it up into pieces and uses the rags to clean her bathroom. Is that morally wrong? A family's dog is killed by a car in front of their house. They heard that dog meat is delicious, so they cut up the dog's body and cook it and eat it for dinner. Is that morally wrong? And why? Julie is traveling in France on summer vacation from college with her brother, Mark. One night, they decide it would be interesting and fun if they tried making love. Julie was already taking birth control pills, but Mark uses a condom too, just to be safe. They both enjoy the sex, but decide not to do it again. They keep the night as a special secret, which makes them feel closer to each other. Is this morally wrong, and why? Haidt uses these and even more shocking examples to prove that our responses to these scenarios are based on intuition and not reason. Often, even when we are influenced by logical reason, it often invokes another intuition from the moral blueprint. Ever had that moment when someone says something and it just speaks to you? Our intuition rules, and we usually can't be swayed to think otherwise. Why is it wrong that the family ate the dog? The dog was already dead. They didn't kill it. In the story, no one is harmed. And yet, many of us hear that and say, it is still very wrong. Even if we can't explain why, even when reason fails, we can define our morality. Okay, but that doesn't explain why one group of people would say a situation that I just shared is wrong, and another group would say, well, it's icky, it's not society's norm, and it's not wrong. Haidt's central metaphor is that our morality is like a tongue with six taste receptors. There are six moral foundations upon which we build our moral code. Everyone has different tastes. I love cilantro, and my partner Lois thinks it tastes like dish soap. She, on the other hand, really likes all things licorice, and I can't even stand the smell of fennel. Some people can describe a fine wine with 15 different flavors that it evokes, and other people can taste that same wine and say, I like it, no, you don't. Taste is unique to each of us, and we can find tastes that we have in common and those that we don't. Haidt's model of morality has, again, six moral flavors or foundations, which I'm going to run through real quick. First one is care harm, the most obvious of the moral tastes. It's the bully. It's the one that is pretty universal. Everyone can agree when someone is being harmed. Next is fairness cheating. Think marriage fidelity or broken vending machine that took my money and didn't give me my candy bar. This foundation is based on the dynamics of reciprocity, quid pro quo. As Haidt says, on the left, concerns about equality and social justice are based in part on the Fairness Foundation. On the right, the Tea Party movement is also very concerned about fairness. Everyone cares about fairness. But on the left, fairness often implies equality. But on the right, it means proportionality. People should be rewarded in proportion to what they contribute, even if the outcome is not equal. Loyalty betrayal. This is Lord of the Flies or reality show Survivor. It's Ohio State versus Michigan. This is the foundation of patriotism, rooting for our favorite sports team, donating to our alma mater. The left tends towards universalism and away from nationalism and often has trouble connecting with voters that rely on the loyalty foundation. Authority subversion. I got it all in one picture. I don't know. Authority and hierarchy are frequently associated with their dark side, the abuse of power. And yet authority also provides control and civilization, direction, leadership, and keeps the chaos at bay. We listen to our parents, obey the law, and respect our elders. For example, you might not think twice about slapping a friend in the face with her permission as part of a comedy skit. But if you value the Authority Foundation, you might hesitate to slap your minister in the face with her permission in a comedy skit. The Liberty Oppression Foundation operates in tension with the Authority Foundation. Too much authority may lead to tyranny. So liberals use this foundation universally to lift up the underdog, the victims, pursue civil rights and human rights. Conservatives are more concerned about their group rather than all of humanity. They oppose domination and control by big government as tyranny. And finally, the Sanctity Degradation Foundation. This evolved from our ancestors' need to avoid contaminants for us to stay healthy. It's where cleanliness is next to godliness comes from. Ideas like chastity, kosher and halal diets, virginity pledges are all rooted in this foundation. And the left is not immune. Think organic, non-GMO foods, environmental causes that rail against polluting nature. These all are in the Sanctity Foundation. So how do we put these foundations together? Everyone is on a spectrum on how much they value each of these foundations and what the triggers are. Haidt found that in general, liberals strongly value three of the six foundations, the care harm, the fairness, and liberty. And their most sacred value was care for the oppressed. These charts, by the way, are from an earlier version of his studies before he broke out authority and liberty into two separate categories. So they're only showing five, so I can count, really. Conservatives, on the other hand, generally value the six foundations more equally. Their most sacred value is to preserve the institutions and traditions that sustain a moral community. Here are my results, based on Haidt's test. I'm actually pretty balanced among the foundations, with the exception of the purity or the sanctity, which I score almost zero. Please see me afterwards if you want to discuss that further. If you're interested in finding out where you fit, you can take Haidt's test at yourmorals.org to see where you come out. So, if we take a step back, we've walked through six moral foundations that evolved from basic human needs to thrive in the wilderness to form complex cultures and societies that we have today. Haidt suggests that rather than argue us-them, or right, wrong, conservatives and liberals are really the yin and the yang of our political system. In Chinese philosophy, yin and yang are seemingly opposed forces, but are in fact complementary and interdependent. John Stuart Mill, who was a political economist in the 19th century, said, "A party of order or stability and a party of progress or reform are both necessary elements of a healthy state of political life." And so we walk the careful tightrope of social order and social growth. So what? If you want to understand another group, Haidt says, follow the sacredness. So after reading this book, I found myself applying the moral foundations to many controversies. Let me take one example. Immigration reform. For liberals, this issue falls smack in the middle of their favorite three foundations: care, or more specifically, preventing the harm that is done to undocumented workers and their families, liberty, fighting for the oppressed, and fairness, justice for those that are working, paying taxes, acting as good citizens, but aren't afforded the same benefits as others. For conservatives, this issue is about loyalty, patriotism, and authority, upholding the current laws, but it's also about fairness. Conservatives would argue that it isn't fair to let people come here illegally and stay when others are going through the process legally with delayed or no benefits. They would also argue that it's not fair for undocumented people to get benefits they aren't entitled to, like health care and free education for their children. Both sides are basing their opinions on this issue on their moral foundations. Haidt summarizes saying that people don't adopt their ideologies at random or by soaking up whatever ideas are around them. They're predisposed, but not predestined, within the moral foundations to be liberal, conservative, centrist, somewhere in there. Once people join a political team, or I could insert here a religious organization or some other identifying group, they get ensnared in its moral matrix. They see confirmation of their own narrative everywhere, and it's difficult, maybe even impossible, to convince them that they are wrong if you argue with them from outside their moral matrix. I think it is possible, and even necessary, to continually challenge our own narrative and to understand where our beliefs come from. I think it's just as important to try to understand those we disagree with. I hope that we are reaching a peak in the bipartisan polarity that has frozen our political system and clogged the path to progress. I hope that people are getting fed up with the infotainment media fueling the discussion at the extreme ends of the spectrum and not providing voice for a balanced discussion. I don't know how to get politicians to break the cycle of bumper sticker politics and re-election rhetoric to make real and lasting change for the benefit of the country and its people. But I can reach across the aisle, across the table, across my Facebook feed, and open a dialogue. And if I open a dialogue with someone whose beliefs I disagree with, even strongly disagree with, and I listen especially well, I can be mindful of their moral matrix and seek the common foundation and strengthen the interdependent web of which we all are a part. We close with these words from Rumi. Why struggle to open a door between us when the whole wall is an illusion? Go in peace.